This is The New Criterion. I'm James Panero, Executive Editor. My guest today is Wilfred M. McClay, a 2023-24 visiting critic here at The New Criterion. When not writing for us, Bill is the Victor Davis Hanson Chair in Classical History and Western Civilization at Hillsdale College. And I should add, he is also a 2022 recipient of the Bradley Prize, and much deserved. Bill, welcome.
Thank you, James. It's really a pleasure and an honor to be with you.
On September 28, Bill will deliver this magazine's fifth annual Circle Lecture. We inaugurated this live lecture series as a way of recognizing the New Criterion's full circle of supporters. Listeners, consider joining our circle if you haven't done so already with an annual donation of just $100 or more. Your support underwrites initiatives such as our Visiting Critic Program, the Hilton Kramer Fellowship, and the true cost of the magazine's production. I should add that the Circle also brings us together for these events, since every Circle member receives an invitation to this special lecture. Bill's lecture will also appear as the lead feature in our November 2023 issue. And for those who can't make it, a recording we made available to all of our Circle members soon after the event. To learn more, visit newcriterion.com/circle. The Burden of the Humanities. Bill, that is the title of your talk. So let me start by asking about this word burden. I know that burden has a few meanings, one being a load, and the other a theme. So how do you mean it here?
I mean both. I mean that the humanities are terribly important to our civilization. They're being much abused in our time and have been for quite some time, actually. It's incumbent upon us to recover them. So that is a burden that we bear because of the burden that the humanities bear for our way of life. I don't think that they're only those two meanings, but the burden of humanities, borne by the humanities as a kind of preceptor for our way of life, and the burden borne by us as those to whom the task has fallen to try to do what we can to rescue them and revitalize them as an essential part of the good life.
Now, for this word, humanities, it's the term we use often in education for what it is not the hard sciences, not a trade. Some students believe it also means not employable. This may be one reason why student enrollment in the humanities has recently plummeted. There is a belief that the humanities serve no useful purpose. When I was studying classics, my father liked to joke that I should really study diesel engine repair, since there will always be diesel engines in need of repairing, perhaps more than Latin in need of translating. So first, what is the humanities, and what purpose does it serve if you can't repair a diesel engine by studying it?
Well, I got to deal with the deal at diesel engines first, because we have a government that wants to deal a death blow to all internal combustion engines, diesel and otherwise. So, it's a joke, but not entirely, because if you tie education too much to the student's ability to plug him or herself into the economy as it exists now, you may be dealing with the sort of yesterday's education for tomorrow, which ends up being an education for yesterday. And there's something I think eminently practical about, yes, classics. Let's be bold here. I actually have a son who is a classics scholar, so I believe in the study of classics. My Greek is very poor, my Latin worse. But that doesn't mean I don't love them both and see them as a great source of what we are and what we yet can be. But I think it's much more sensible to educate people in very general ways to sort of develop their ability to think, to solve problems, to work within certain parameters, to carry out disciplined tasks in a way that is both coherent and efficacious. These are much more important, and to do it in a way that one has a sense of there being something at stake in them. That's one of the things colleges has lost, is this sense that anything is at stake. In a institution like Harvard, where the average grade is an A minus, the average grade is an A minus, take that in. There's not a whole lot at stake. Getting in is the hard part, but once you're there, not much is going to be demanded of you. I think it's a myth that some kind of vocational education is going to prepare you for life. I think it's sometimes it's true. Sometimes it's true in the short term, but often people who find their vocation, their occupation, let's call it an occupation rather than vocation, the thing that they've been trained for, the thing that they have expertise in, is simply rendered no longer necessary by developments in technology and the economy. I've met people who, and maybe you have too, who were extremely skilled at the art of setting type by hand.
I was thinking of linotype. It's one of those skills. That
linotype, yes.
Yes.
Linotype, that's a whole different. Linotype operators are not only a dying, they're a dead breed. I don't know whether you'd find a linotype machine anywhere. There were a few, when I was started working in publishing, there were a few letterpress printers out there, Rodney Steinauer, and a few others, and they're all gone now. I greatly admire folks like that, David Godin in book publishing, who always has letterpress books, and God bless them. But none of them would say that that their way was the way to prepare for a profitable occupation in the present world. They would say, however, that developing a sense of typography through using the less developed technologies of the past is a good way to learn the aesthetics. And just as art schools ought to teach drafting and other very basic skills, that used to be part of art education since time immemorial, instead of plunging straight into computers and all of that kind of thing.
And what do we mean when we say humanities then? I mean, what's the history of the humanities?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's something that I think has developed over time. The sort of Greco-Roman notion of the study of the humanities is part of that story. It certainly, there's a recovery of classical learning in the Italian Renaissance, the Renaissance more generally. I mean, it's almost a definition of the Renaissance as the recovery of classical learning. I think the term humanities really emerges in the 19th century. I think you can find vestiges of it ahead of time, but the notion of dividing up the curricular offerings of the academy into humanities, social sciences, and natural sciences, that's, I think, in the 20th century, probably, that you really see that development. And what you said at the beginning about for a lot of people, humanities are just what is not social sciences or natural sciences. Even things like fields like communications, which, as far as I can tell, is not really a field, but there are a lot of things that are not fields that have departmental office space in the present day academy. They are just sort of stuffed in there. But I think the Hammondites have brought this on themselves because their leading exponents have been inarticulate on the subject of what matters about what they do. And I try in my talk to use a very simple definition, which I think is actually more workable than it seems at first glance. And that is, it is the study of human things in human terms. And one of the ways I mean that is that there was a great rage back in the 50s or so for the application of psychoanalysis to the study of literature. So you had everybody going after Dostoevsky, Hawthorne. Oh my God, Hawthorne was a sitting duck for that kind of analysis. And what you're doing there really is you're no longer interested in literature. You're interested in the decoding of literature. It's a kind of cryptography rather than a real effort to understand human things in human terms. And not that psychoanalysis is not a human invention, but psychoanalysis, when it considers itself to be a science of the human mind, an extension of medicine, that's something different from high psychoanalysis as an imaginative system. I am interested in psychoanalysis as a kind of one of William Blake's systems that is used to keep from being controlled by another man's. But it's an imaginative construct. And it's fascinating on those terms, as a work of art, even, that pretends to be a science. But when we reduce literature, and more currently to politics, to political concerns, to identity, to, you know, what's the skin color or what's the plumbing of the author, or the national origin, ethnic origins, whatever, of the author of a work of fiction or nonfiction, or a work of art, when we become reduced to that kind of consideration, we've lost all sense that the art in question is a form of knowledge, is a form that is all its own, that deserves to be apprehended on its own terms rather than being reduced to something else. Mm.
You know, a little while ago, I was at a party and someone collapsed in the crowd. They were fine, but there were some doctors in the room just to make sure. And it's times like this when the humanities might be questioned. But yes. I thought to myself, at least I could write this person's obituary if it came to it. Some usefulness there. And I will say also, majority of the editors here at the New Criterion were classics majors. So you got that.
Well, yeah, no, I actually am aware of that. But I'm not kowtowing to you because in my own family, we have the classics well represented.
But as you say, beyond the issue of utility, there's this issue of politics in the humanities. And I think it's related to utility because we are taught history by these people to see how it conforms to some prejudice, Marx or Freud, as you say, or Foucault or some other grand theorist. And now how much has politics changed the study of humanities and kind of led to its own immolation?
Oh, it's been enormously destructive, and it eliminates the need for the humanities. If all the humanities are as an object lesson in the political desiderata, then why bother? Why skip the middle man? Just go straight to the politics. Why read Conrad as an exemplar of colonialism? Why read any number of authors as sort of incomplete Marxists who have a little bit of fuzziness on the edges when they try to create interesting characters and don't stick to the Marxian narrative? It really obviates the need for the work of art as itself a form of expression that has its own integrity, that has its own message. I was thinking today, this may be a little off the point, I hope not, but about the difference between teaching by way of precepts and teaching by way of parables, as Jesus does. I mean, why does Jesus use all these parables? Why does he use all these stories that that you really have to work at interpreting? Well, maybe it's because that's actually the very best way to communicate those things. Maybe if you tell somebody you tell them the story of the parable son, and then you tell them what they're to conclude from the parable son. That's one thing. If you just tell them what they're to conclude without telling them the parable, they've really got nothing, you know. You have to tell the story. Mm. You have to work through the narrative. You have to experience the unfolding of meaning in time, and that can't be captured by a theory that's extraneous to the work of art itself.
Well, and it seems now, even beyond the era of theory and the era of political correctness, that now we have an era where words are violence, and yes, expression itself has some kind of power that has to be avoided at all costs. So
yes,
context doesn't matter. It's just the utterance of words or that can set you off. I mean, this is a very strange development.
There is generally some sort of historical argument behind the violence is words, or words are violence. Actually, it's interesting. The converse is also true now in the current acceptation that violence is a form of expression. It's legitimate as a form of expression.
Yeah, right. Violence is allowed. That's free expression. But the words that might set off that violence are violence. It's a very strange flipping.
We're living in a strange moment, but let us hope it will pass it somehow or other. But it won't pass of its own volition, that's for sure. The students at Middlebury College who shooed Charles Murray and his host off the stage by breaking her shoulder blade or whatever, they were the ones who making famous this cry, which originates with a Nobel address by Toni Morrison, words are violence. But if words are violence, that means there's no safe zone. People talk about safe spaces. Well, literature should be a safe space. That's part of the value of words. Words are intermediaries between thought and action. They mediate between thought and action. And that's the realm in which the arts operate, is in that mediating territory. And it needs to be given its own space. It needs to be given its own protections if it's made immediately answerable to political considerations. Then again, all you have is the politics, the naked politics. So why bother with the art? Why bother with the words? Just beat people over the head. Since the art of persuasion is the art of violence. It's really, I'm afraid that's not an exaggeration. It's coming to that there's a kind of sense that one doesn't have to argue with anymore with opposing points of view. That's really the core meaning to me of woke is it's as they would say, binary. You either get it or you don't. You either are awake or you're not. And there's no, you either see in the light or you're in the dark.
Yeah, you're racist or you're anti-racist. You can't sit on the sidelines, right?
Yeah, and there's no redemption for those who have not seen the light. This is, again, part of the burden of the humanities, to come back to our theme, is to insist, no, it is not so. That's such a view, such a horrifying, reductive, simplistic, dehumanizing view, if I may use that word, dehumanizing, is not all that we're about. And the humanities, even, there are very dehumanizing philosophers. You've named some of them, Nietzsche, Foucault, etc., Althusser, some who even set their sights against humanism itself. We have anti-humanist philosophers who believe that the earth will be better off if we're gone. I wonder who will write that obituary. No one will be left to write it.
That's right.
That's part of the humanities, part of the debate in humanities. But when it becomes the controlling influence, then you don't have humanities anymore. You don't. And one of the things that I conclude in the lecture, this is one of my more venturesome parts of the lecture, is that it does seem to me that we're now, I promise you, I'm not going to talk about AI. That's, I don't know about you, I'm sick of hearing about AI, but especially from people who don't really know anything about it. And nobody knows where this is leading. Nobody can pretend to know. But I'm of the opinion that it's very likely to lead to some very bad things. It's almost certain to lead to some very bad things. And we need to be clear about what it is to be human. That's really what the humanities are all about. From the time of the Greeks, you know, to through the Middle Ages, through the Renaissance, there's always a way in which humanity, what it is to be human, has to be defined in opposition to something else, to the gods, to, as you see in Homer and much of ancient literature, to the animals, to machines, the great theme of the Romantic era, and now I think to a different kind of machine that can actually perform some of the more routine duties of human beings, and leaving us with the sense of what is it that's special about it? Is it just our ability to fly into rages and have mental illness? Is that the distinctiveness of the human? Surely not. but obviously, when it comes to AI, I'm more drawn to the complacent people who say, "Oh well, there's no way that they're going to develop a machine that can think, that can actually be creative and all of that." And there does seem to be some basis for that view. I'm not confident about it, but in any event, each one of these sorts of advances raises the stakes for us to figure out what is dying an inevitable, ineluctable, intrinsic part of being human. Yeah. Wallace Stevens' famous words in the Sunday Morning repeats it twice: "Death is the mother of beauty." I'd like to live in a world where there's beauty. Does that mean?
Well, on the question of what can be done about it, as a professor at Hillsdale College, you are living proof that an alternative exists.
Well, it is, and I your listeners should know I came here 2.5 years ago. I actually retired from my previous job. I could be living the life of Riley, you know, next door to Obama and Martha's Vineyard, and just but I wanted to come here. I wanted to come here, and contrary to what people believe, it's actually a very beautiful place. It's in a very obscure part of the country, and there are no good restaurants. But other than that, you have the best students I've ever encountered.
Yeah, tell us about what is it like? What is the college and the students? What are they like in comparison to academia at large?
Well, there are a lot of them that have been either homeschooled or had gone to classical schools or had not your usual either public or independent school background. A lot of them are very bright. Our acceptance rate is getting down into the teens, so we're not quite at Ivy League level, nor do we want to be. But they're inquisitive. They're completely unjaded. This is the thing that is most impressive to me, is that I teach a course called Western Heritage, which is part of the core, and we, among other things, we rehearse all the battles of the Reformation, and you know, Luther and Calvin and so on, and our students take these very seriously. These issues Justification by faith alone, sola scriptura. These are live issues.
These are living issues for them. Yeah,
they are, and those are not the only ones. But I just picked those because I have a real sense of delight that they feel these issues as sort of existentially essential, that they must address them. Yeah, and when I've had instances in which I spoke rather broadly of free will, and then as soon as my office hours come around, the Calvinist student in the class comes in and says, "Wait a minute, you caricatured our position, and let me have it." So I love that. I really am so pleased with and proud of our students. They're a breed apart. They're rather wholesome, believe me, that's a relief. It's just pleasant. They have omnivorous interests. The campus is very small, and it's in this very small town where there's not really any great dazzling attractions to be had. Of course, the nearest big city is Detroit, which is not exactly a magnet for, this is not Manhattan. There's so much going on campus that they hardly have time to think about going to Lansing or Ann Arbor, which are the two sort of closest. That's where we go for restaurants. I feel like I've gained so much by coming here in comparison to what I lost by coming to a relatively obscure rural part of the country, and in a state that has very unattractive politics, by the way. I recognize that coming in. But it's all about the students and colleagues, too. This is the far and away the most collegial place I've ever been, and I've been in some pretty uncollegial ones. I think I've experienced now the full range of possibilities, but Hillsdale is definitely at the sunny end. We know what we're about. This is something Larry Arn says all the time, and he's right. We know what we're about, and we don't suffer a lot of indecision and Hamlet-like pauses over, are we doing the right thing here? No, we know what we're doing. I would compare this to, I served on the board of a certain very famous liberal arts college that I won't name, but my friends will know what I'm referring to, that's very famous for its program of study. When I found myself on the board dealing constantly with board members who thought we needed to change and be just like other colleges. So coming from the top, including the president's office, there was tremendous uncertainty and indecision about this fantastic program, which I had experienced firsthand as a student myself. And yet there's none of the confidence at this place that we have at Hillsdale. Mm-hmm.
I think I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I think you do. Larry Arn is a very fine and inspirational leader, but I don't think anybody should attribute all of this to him, that it's been built up over, really from the time when the college made the decision in the 70s that it would not accept federal funds.
Right.
This was the key decision, it has not been easy, but the college is thriving. I have to say, one of the things about it is that we, all of us feel, and I think I can say this without hesitation, that we have to play a role in that. Anything that the administration tells me they want me to show up for and speak for the college to donors or have donors sit on my classes at a moment's notice, I say yes, absolutely, because that's part of my job. Part of my job is to ensure that we raise our own keep. You know, I often say to people, you know, the folks who run institutional advancement here, they have to think before they get out of bed in the morning, how am I going to raise $1 million today? Because we're constantly having to raise more and more and more money.
But what's amazing is that there are so many donors who really have no direct connection to the college who contribute throughout the country.
Oh, yes. And they're incredibly enthusiastic. I go places and people come up to me, people I don't know at all and have nothing to do with the college will come up to me and thank me for what I'm doing. They know me because I've done online courses that they've seen, so they know my face. But I'm not accustomed to this. I can't say I always like it because I'm a person who basically would like to live like a hobbit if I could. But it's not a possibility. And I wouldn't be doing right by the college if I didn't. So it's really nice. And James, you have this experience too. This is something we share. It's great to work for an organization you really believe in. Mm-hmm. Not all of us in this life get that privilege. And I haven't always believed in a deep way in the institutions I worked for, not the way I do this one. I believed that I've had an opportunity, really a God-given opportunity, to influence the lives of individual students for better. But appeals to the institution and institutional well-being have generally fallen on deaf ears with me. I see so much that's wrong and lacking in direction. And it boils down to that they can't tell you why they're doing what they're doing. Uh-huh. They can't explain what their mission is. We can. We're very good at that here. And most people, the kids who give tours on the campus, I hear them. They're holding forth about the liberal arts, and they make a very good presentation of the college.
Well, many other schools, what they're mainly doing is apologizing for their past.
They're living on stolen land and all of that sort of virtue signaling stuff. And now we don't do that here. There's not time for that. We have too much work to do.
Land of Hope, An Invitation to the Great American Story is the title of your 2020 history published by Encounter Books. Daniel Henninger of the Wall Street Journal calls your book the most balanced, nuanced history of the United States I've read in the past 50 years. What gives you particular hope in the story of America?
It's actually more the past than the present that we have shown resiliency so many times and in so many ways. We're very resilient people. I think we've sort of talked ourselves and educated ourselves into a kind of fragility that's in the current dispensation. That's not really, I hate to sound like Obama, but it's not who we are. there will come a point. I think that some of the recent, you know, the COVID fiasco is an example that the way in which the general public, I think, is coming to a point where they may not put up much longer with these institutions that. In ways both subtle and not so subtle, tyrannize over us. But I think we are, it's as much because of our obstreperous qualities that disorderly people. and that's actually one of the things I like about America, is that we don't, you know, it's the great distinction between Americans and Canadians, that Americans are colossally impatient. Canadians will just queue up and stand in line forever. Americans will look for a way around, look for some kind of way to get what they want faster. I think in many ways, the restlessness of America means that we are not, I think, are not tameable. I hope we're not tameable. I think that's been our pattern.
Well, we'll always do the right thing once we've tried everything else. Right?
That's right. It's what is it, Churchill or Bismarck? Somebody who knew what he was talking about. That there's an experimentalism. I mean, that's a more positive way to put it, but there's an experimentalism about American life that certain things have to run their course. I think there's a lot of follies we've run past the point of refuting them. Now we just have to endure them until they die of their own inanition. But this is one of the things about moving to the heartland that's been very, very moving to me, emotionally moving in the sense that there still is a tremendous, in this part of the country, southern Michigan, the tremendous devastation brought by the outsourcing of jobs, the destruction of the industrial base. You know, the UAW strike that's beginning could end up really being very, very bad for this area in particular. I don't know how long it's going to go on, but and nevertheless, there is much of that Midwestern kind of sensible, resilient, self-reliant quality here, as in the past. We haven't lost that. It's not visible in our media, in our public entertainments, but these are things that are controlled and formulated by a small group of people who don't necessarily have that role in our national life by divine right, they can be displaced. The people have to do it, though. I think that there's no political choice that can be separated from a sort of rise of unwillingness to tolerate the indignities of this way. Mm. And also, paradoxically, I would say, because I've just praised us for being restless and disobedient people, a certain kind of civic virtue, mm-hmm. a feeling that if we don't step up, there isn't anybody who will.
Well, that's the virtue of philanthropy that supports Hillsdale College.
Yes, yes.
That's a remarkable story, yeah. And your book, Land of Hope, also now has a student edition that is going into some schools, I understand.
Yeah, yeah. We are trying our best to, it's very hard. You know, the public schools, it's partly, I think it's more the fact that there are accustomed channels. It's all mobbed up in its own way, academic publishing. And so, you know, I have a friend who worked for years at one of the big three textbook publishers. I won't say which, but it's a name you would know. And she told me that the making of sausage is a pristine art compared to the making of textbooks. And it involves all kinds of compromises and with marketing considerations, political considerations, everything but a sort of accurate view of the past. I think one of the virtues of my book was that one person wrote it. I didn't have to consult the committee. I didn't have to meet with stakeholders, whatever they are, to determine whether I had an acceptable presentation of their particular group. I didn't have to run any of those kinds of gauntlets. I didn't have to deal with textbook committees that in states and localities, counties and so on will determine the textbooks that are adopted. Little by little, we're making our way, though. Florida, Georgia, Arizona, several other states have endorsed the book. And I think once the student edition that you've described becomes more widely known, I think people will want to use it. For one thing, James, it's cheaper than any of the others. We are much cheaper. It's,
well, when you talk about a mob racket, I mean, textbooks, yeah. That's it.
Yeah, you can't find a textbook that costs less than three figures now. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just absurd. And of course, what they're trying to do is, and this is really goes to questions about the humanities too. They're trying to eliminate the book. They're trying to make it an all online matter that's serviced through their platform, which in true Orwellian fashion can be updated at a moment's notice, and you won't know what was left behind. You know, there's this, the permanence of a book. You know, when I went to visit, Rodney Steinauer once, this great compositor and publisher, and I saw by his desk saying "literis scripta manet," which means, as you know, that the written word remains. I think it comes from a longer saying of Horace, perhaps. Maybe not. That's all the classicists will jump on me if I'm getting it wrong. But it's a saying about how the spoken word disappears, but the written word remains.
Yeah, and the online word disappears, as you say, as well. Just trying to get a copy of If I Ran the Zoo by Dr. Seuss these days. It's all been pulped.
Yes. Yeah. And the rewriting of Roald Dahl and Ian Fleming, good grief, you know, to make it acceptable to the eyes of woke 21st century ingenues. I mean, this is madness. And it's a treason. It's really a treason against the authors, against the culture, to think that in a sense, all there is the present. Mm. That's really what this is saying. Yeah. All there is we in the present.
It's presentism. No, exactly.
Yeah, it is.
Well, I'm delighted to say that your appointment as our visiting critic continues through our current publishing season to June 2024. What are you considering next for our pages?
Oh, wow. Well, you know, I've got this is being recorded, isn't it? I could regret saying it. I do have a few things. There's something I've been noodling for a while. I've actually told Roger about it, that I gave a lecture at the University of San Diego Law School, which is on its way to be made into a non-conservative law school, unfortunately. But Gail Harriet, who's been in your pages, is a professor there, and she was the one who invited me. What a grand person she is. Anyway, on why it's important we fail to make a distinction between freedom of speech and freedom of expression. I'm taking on a lot of constitutional bugbears and shibboleths and cats in taking that on. And I don't know the constitutional law well enough to know whether there's any hope that what I'm advocating for could ever possibly happen. But it really kind of goes to this violence, speech is violence sort of issue, that if we don't distinguish between speech that is merely expressive and speech that is the kind of speech that, irrespective of what the jurisprudence is, what the founders really had in mind in protecting political speech, what Mill had in mind in protecting political speech, if we don't make that distinction, if a primal scream is the same, or any number of other things, then there's no meaningful arena for the kind of speech that is the speech required for deliberation in a free society. Mm-hmm. And that's what Aristotle said, that the thing that distinguishes us from the animals is logos, and by which he really meant speech, the the power to deliberate together with rational tools about those things that are our common interests and concerns.
Wonderful. Yeah, well, I would say readers, stay tuned for that one. That sounds
you like
great.
That idea?
I do. You have been listening to The New Criterion. I'm James Panero. My guest today is Wilfred M. Clay, a visiting critic of The New Criterion. On September 28th, Bill will present his talk, The Burden of the Humanities, as our fifth annual Circle Lecture. A version will also appear in the November 2023 issue of the magazine. Listeners, unburden yourself and consider joining us for this event and others as a supporter of the publication. For more, visit newcriterion.com/circle. Bill, thank you for joining us and see you next week.
Thank you very much.